You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producers Arno, Nicholas and Kaze. This week on The Wire, we are continuing on with our election coverage where we speak to politicians, academics, activists, experts and more about different policy areas leading up to the election. This week, we are focusing on foreign affairs. Ewhai Ahine coming up on the show for our regular catch-up with the Green Party. I speak to Golriz Garaman about granting amnesty for Pacific migrant workers who have overstayed their visa, issues with the immigration system in Aotearoa, and holding international powers to account for human rights abuses. Arno, what have you got for us today?
I interviewed Sense Partners economist Dr. Curtin Lees to get an overview of rising immigration numbers and how it's likely to affect us. And I interviewed barrister and columnist Dave Ananth to see how rising immigration is likely to affect businesses.
Nicholas, what have you got for us today?
I spoke to Dr. Nina Su, the Epsom candidate for the Opportunities Party, about the party's housing and foreign policy.
And Kaze, our brand new producer, how has your shift been today?
Yeah, pretty good, thanks.
That's good to hear. What have you got for us today?
I spoke to Mark Roach, a spokesperson from the Anti-AUKUS Coalition, about the possibility of New Zealand joining the alliance.
He aha o whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395, or give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Ka oe e wariwari e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anohi pakiheri roki roki mā runga I te pai tuku tuku o irirangi poho mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com, and you can catch all of our stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
I don't know, and frankly, the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, today I spoke to Green MP Golriz Garaman. We first started off by discussing the Greens' proposal to increase the Best Start payment by 50% and also extend its eligibility. For our focus on foreign affairs, we also discussed issues with the immigration system and the Greens' involvement in holding international powers to account for human rights abuses. Here is that interview. The Green Party announced that it's supporting doubling the Best Start payment, which would make it available for children under 3 years old. How would this increase from $69 to $140 help address poverty here in Aotearoa?
Yeah, first of all, our approach with all of our election packages, and this one sits within our guaranteed minimum income ending poverty package, is that the government must have a role in ending hardship and addressing the climate crisis, that all of the decisions of government sit squarely in terms of the ways that New Zealanders experience the world. And so we know that 1 in 10 children in Aotearoa are growing up in poverty. For Māori, that's 1 in 5. And often people kind of talk about, what does that mean? Well, that's actually based on very real indicators. Like, do you have a second pair of shoes? Do you have more than 2 hot meals per week? These are real indicators of poverty, and there's absolutely no reason for any child in Aotearoa to be experiencing this. So we have a fully costed policy that would double the Best Start payment to 140, and it would make it universally available to all children under 3 years of age. Those are critical years. We've heard this from the Children's Commissioner for years. We've heard it from health professionals, and we say, just as every person in New Zealand in their later years deserves to have universal support that should apply to children as well. And child poverty is absolutely costing us in every possible way in our communities. Whether you care about the bottom line, it's costing our healthcare system later on, it's costing us in mental health care later on, in terms of education. And so there is an easy solution to this. We would pay for it with our wealth tax that applies to only 0.7% of the top wealth holders in Aotearoa. And it would make a very, very real difference for whānau.
So this week, National and New Zealand First both announced various penalties for those on the Job Seeker Support Benefit, which ACT has also supported. What impact do you think these policies would have on low-income earners?
Well, I mean, first of all, they're devastating and cruel, especially in the midst of a global financial crisis, I would call it, but certainly a cost of living crisis in New Zealand. They would absolutely punish people struggling and in absolute need of a social safety net. But in particular, they would be punishing children and young people. It's beyond cruel to say that we, as a government, would witness hardship and turn to punishing people who are experiencing that hardship instead of supporting them. So it shows what the next government could be, which is one that would make things harder for most New Zealanders, or one that would approach the great crises of our time with not only compassion, but evidence-based policies.
How would the Greens then aim to help people get off the benefit and not have to rely on support from benefits and into meaningful and sustainable employment?
Well, first of all, not everyone on our welfare system is on the job seeker benefit. I mean, we have people who are sole carers of children who shouldn't be sanctioned and pushed into work rather than supported to raise those children as best they can to join society and to join the next generation, to go to school and to thrive later on. We have people on sickness and disability benefits who would be sanctioned and pushed into work pushed to prove over and over again that they in fact can't work, rather than be supported to be employed in whatever way they want to and can be safely, but also to just actually have a safe, secure income that would put food on the table and pay the rent. So actually the welfare system isn't there to punish and push people into employment rather than to actually see what each welfare beneficiary in fact needs, but also what our communities need. What I would say the guaranteed minimum income, which is $385 for every single person who needs it, plus things like the Best Start payment and payments for children or for carers of children to raise those children in a way that's safe and healthy, would mean is that actually people can have food on the table, have a warm, dry home, and work if they can. We would raise the abatement limit to $60,000, which means that people who do go into employment part-time, which is what people need to get your confidence back after, for example, being the primary caregiver of a child and out of work for some time or out of work for whatever reason, you would need to be able to start work part-time without being penalised or pushed off the benefit immediately. And we would make the first $10,000 of anyone's income in New Zealand tax-free. So to make it safe for people to start work and to go into employment without being punished off the benefit is to us the absolute best way to ease people into the workforce without losing their guaranteed income, which is in the welfare system. That isn't currently happening. People are having to choose between going into work part-time and losing their benefits or staying on the benefit, which we all know is below the poverty line, suffering, sinking further and further into poverty, and we know what that means for every single other part of our society, whether it's health, whether it's justice, whether it's education, it's absolutely harmful.
Yeah, we have to move on to our next topic, which we also saw that Labor has recently announced it would ensure amnesty for Pacific migrant workers who have overstayed their visas. What do you think about Labor's approach to addressing this issue?
Well, we've been pushing for some time for safe and appropriate amnesties for so-called overstayers. We had 3 years ago Pacific community leaders and migrant groups launching a petition asking for an amnesty for overstayers and pathways to residency. So finally, we're glad to see Labor doing something, but it absolutely doesn't go far enough. So Labor's policy that was just announced was an amnesty for those who've been in Aotearoa for 10 years or more, which is fine. That is as it should be. But it doesn't recognise the realities of our immigration system, which is to say that we very often keep people in essential work. I mean, we're talking about people working in our healthcare system, caring for our elderly, building infrastructure on low incomes that don't meet the residency pathways that are provided for in our immigration system. You often have to earn a certain amount to be able to apply for residency or permanent residency and get that pathway to citizenship. We keep people on low incomes within the immigration work visa system, even though they're filling essential roles. And those people are often one job loss away from becoming deemed an overstayer. They would have often been here for years, although it may be less than a decade, which is the limit that Labor has set, but they'll often have been here for 6 or 7 years. They'll have potentially children who are in the education system here. We saw when COVID happened and there were job losses that those on work visas didn't receive, for example, the COVID-created supplement. And often that makes migrants reliant on very exploitative employment situations. But we know that when a job loss does happen for a migrant worker who may have been here for years, that immediately puts them into that extreme risk category of being an overstayer, makes them far more vulnerable to exploitation. And that is the focus of our universal amnesty and coupled with the safe pathways to residency. So unless we're going to provide migrants with safe, dignified pathways and support to integrate here, we can't punish them for suddenly becoming overstayers despite their best efforts to actually seek residency. Often people don't know that once they get here, they can keep renewing their work visa and keep doing these essential roles that we need, but that they will never be allowed to settle because we deem them to be too low in terms of earnings.
So the Green Party would support Labor's call to have it be 10 years?
We support that only in that it provides some relief for some of those who need it, but it absolutely needs to go further and recognise that these gaps are in our system and that all overstayers, so-called overstayers, need to have the security of pathways to residency. There's no one here who has not come here to fill an essential work visa role. That's who we're talking about. We're talking about migrant workers who are here doing work that we have on the job shortage list, or students who are funding our higher education system. And within weeks or days of something happening, a course finishing, a job loss, they become overstayers, and then suddenly in that panic they become very vulnerable to exploitation and may remain here for years, even doing that same job, but in a really vulnerable position. And so unless we're going to actually recognise that we need to fix our immigration system and make pathways for residency far more accessible, we can't continue to punish people.
And just lastly, in this term of government, we have seen New Zealand condemn international powers like Israel, Iran, Russia and China for human rights abuses that they are committing. What role has the Greens had in holding these powers to account compared to other parties?
Well, to my mind, the government's actually been fairly slow in joining international calls to condemn mass atrocities and other human rights violations. So in terms of what's happening in Iran with the Women Life Freedom Movement and the murder of Mahsa Amini, the young Kurdish woman who was killed by forces for showing too much hair, which is what Iranian women are dealing with right now. We took months, we were months behind in condemning that regime. We did end up condemning the regime in our UN forums, but we didn't create a special personalized sanctions regime against the leaders of that nation. And I'm not talking about trade sanctions, but I'm talking about the kind of sanctions that we created when the war in Ukraine broke out. That is to say that we had named oligarchs, defense force members, and members of the Russian government as people who are most responsible for those atrocities in Ukraine, and made it unlawful for New Zealand to hold funds, to allow travel and to do business in terms of both the private and public sector with those named individuals. That's what other nations have done when it comes to Iran, and the New Zealand government has sustained its refusal to do that. So we've done a little bit. We haven't quite done enough, and I think the other example that's really meaningful to me as an area where we fall short is that, for example, when the Taliban took over Afghanistan, we absolutely refused to create a special visa category for at-risk Afghans, whereas we did create a 4,000 special visa category for Ukraine. And we did that rightly. It was for family members of Ukrainian New Zealanders. It probably didn't go far enough in that we didn't facilitate their travel. But for Afghanistan, even though there was a massive displacement crisis, all we did was to issue some public statements, but we didn't in fact stand with the people of Afghanistan. And you know, just even today, I've done interviews on the 20 children from Afghanistan, 20, that's a tiny handful that we did resettle here in the fall of Kabul, but that Immigration New Zealand are refusing to reunite with their parents. So to say that New Zealand is the, you know, the independent principled voice that we'd like to be isn't super true anymore. You know, we're not the nation of the Tampa boat resettlement when we came to aid the boat with people from the Middle East, Afghanistan and other places that had just suffered atrocities, when Australia refused them, when we are currently refusing to reunite 20 young people with literally their immediate family, which is all they're asking for.
So just quickly then, why is it important to have the Greens, and you would hope from the Greens you would want to be in government potentially, but even in Parliament, to ensure equitable condemnation of these atrocities that are going on?
Well, it has only been with Greens asking these questions that we even got the condemnation of Iran. It was only with Greens in government that we pushed for the other really important foreign affairs issue this term, which was the COVID vaccine. And New Zealand was incredibly late to supporting the lifting of intellectual property costs on the COVID vaccine, which third world nations were calling for. It was only after repeated questions in the House and in Select Committee that the government actually joined that international call. But I would also say that it has only ever been the Greens in successive governments that have lifted the voices of those that are most marginalised. So for us, having Palestinian statehood in our manifesto this term will mean that in government we may finally join the three quarters of the world's nations who recognise Palestine, who do stand with displaced people by redoubling our refugee quota, which is, again, our policy, and actually being a good citizen of the world, even though we are very far away.
And that was the Green Party's Gulruz Gharraman discussing granting amnesty to migrant workers who have overstayed their visas, issues with the immigration system, and condemning international powers for human rights abuses.
I don't know how to say this, Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
It's time for our election catch-up with Dr. Nina Su from the Opportunities Party.
The Opportunities Party has released a plan to institute a land value tax as a measure to help stabilise our fraught housing market. The tax would see landowners pay 0.75% of their land value as an annual tax on residential properties. Alongside this, they've proposed removing the Brightline test as a measure to stop land banking. I spoke to Dr. Nina Su, the Opportunity Party's Epsom candidate, about their housing policy, as well as their TL visa program that would be aimed at generating revenue from wealthy migrants looking to come to New Zealand. I began by asking Dr. Su how the land value tax would work.
So in terms of why we chose the land value tax, is because, and it is only just for residential urban land. The reason why we did that is because that is the main problem in our economy, is that we are just basically, we've got a housing market with bits tacked on. You know, as Bernard Hickey, one of our journalists in New Zealand, has said, you know, we basically sell existing property back and forth to each other, and calling that a profit. Right, we've got this speculative housing market, and people are buying and selling land and property, raising, you know, the value over time. And that's affecting our rents, that's affecting people's mortgages. And, you know, the average person in New Zealand over the last couple of years has increased in wealth, but everyone feels poor. Like, why is that? Well, that's because we've got an economy based on housing that will just keep going up and up and up and up, and that's just not sustainable. We need to house people, right? And the reason why we put in a land, why we want to put in a land value tax, is because we want there to be regulations on things like healthy housing, right? Making sure that the homes that we are housing people in are of good quality. But because a lot of people make money off of the land value and the housing value going up and up and up, they make more money through that than sometimes just through renting. There's not a lot of incentive for people to actually rent their homes out if they've got lots of properties. So a land value tax means that people will actually be incentivized to actually rent their homes out. So we've got a problem with ghost homes in New Zealand, right? We don't know the full amount, but we've got some ghost homes in New Zealand where people essentially are like either land banking with no property, like no housing on the land, or we're land banking where we just have property and people aren't doing them up to actually meet healthy home standards, so can't rent them out. And so just hold that property for capital gains, basically, right? Hmm. That's why we want to do a land value tax and also incentivize people to actually build more. So instead, so if you've got two pieces of land next to each other in the same community, same size, whatever, the land value tax will be the same whether there's one house or three houses on that same piece of land. So it incentivizes people to actually build more and build smarter with that same piece of land, and that will increase our supply. So more houses that weren't rented out will come out into the market, and also people will build more smarter as well to actually improve our supply.
Another part of your housing policy is removing the Brightline test, which I found quite interesting. Is it not counterintuitive to stable housing to remove a barrier for people who want to sell quickly and speculate on the market?
So if you have a land value tax, that is the one thing that has been shown around the world in some places to actually stabilize the housing market and increase supply and make it more affordable. So the reason why we want to remove the Brightline test is because people are just holding on to property because of the Brightline test instead of selling it or taking the opportunity to actually do the house up to then be able to sell somebody else. Or there are people who need to, like, they've got a current tenancy and they have been there for a while, and so the house might not actually meet healthy home standard, but they actually only have to meet healthy home standard if it's a new tenancy, if that makes sense, right? So we want the Brightline test removed because we want more homes to be sold off to people who will either make the house livable or sell it to people who will want to, like, actually live in the house rather than use it as an investment property, if that makes sense. So the Brightline test is encouraging people to hold, right?
And I just wanted to ask you briefly a little bit of a yes or no on this one. National has come under fire for their foreign buyers policy. Is removing the ban on foreign buyers something that Top would think about doing?
No. No, absolutely not. I don't think that that's not something that we would want to do. I think it's probably one of the worst parts of the National Party tax policy is to use foreign buyers' tax to, you know, offset their tax cuts. I think it's ridiculous because it will inflate the housing market. Like, I think about my own home. So I'm a renter. I rent a two-bedroom unit with my partner, and it's, you know, part of a two-flat kind of house. Right? So there's other tenants in the place next door to us in the same house, essentially, in one property. And because of the land value of the area, you know, our place is nice. It's not luxury, but it's assessed, the whole property is assessed at $2.5 million of CV value, basically, right? So when we talk about this $2 million number as a luxury property, you know, our property that we're renting is going to come into this foreign buyer's, you know, $2 million cap or whatever the minimum, right? So there's going to be a lot of properties like this that are sitting on a lot of land value. They're not luxury, but they're quite high value. And it's going to end up in that $2 million category that National want foreign buyers to be able to buy. And this is just where people are just living, like regular people are living. So I think that that's a really, really silly policy that's, one, not going to generate the revenue that they want. And it's also going to push, you know, homes that are just under the $2 million mark into the $2 million bracket just so that they can be sold to foreign buyers as well. So that's absolutely not what we want in our affordable housing plan.
Just for the last question, I want to switch over to foreign policy. And there's not a lot of foreign policy that you've released, but you have released a Teal Visa program, which is quite interesting. So I just wanted to ask you to explain the Teal Visa and what implications it could have for the future of New Zealand's immigration.
Yeah, sure. So firstly, I'll just say, as the health spokesperson, foreign policy is not something that is, or immigration is not something that is my specialty. But for the Teal Visa, what it is really is New Zealand, right? It's a country that a lot of people want to come to because geopolitically we're very safe, right? We're a developed country with a lot of access to, you know, relatively, I mean, we're talking about public services, like, not doing so well in New Zealand, but on the grand scheme of things, it's doing better than a lot of other places, right? We've got a lot of access to natural resources, people love the lifestyle here, especially if you have money, right? So it's an attractive place for overseas very wealthy people to come to New Zealand. And we already have this visa. It's called the, I can't remember what it's called now, but the Active Investor Plus visa, right? So people, if they want to come to New Zealand and they have lots of money, they can bring millions of dollars into New Zealand and invest locally, and that gives them a 3 or 4 year visa to live in New Zealand with their family and eventually get residency, right? So we can already do that. But there are some limitations in terms of what they can invest in, and that money goes back to them eventually after 3 or 4 years. And how they invest it is weighted differently. So it's $15 million, but then if they do a direct investment into a direct business that is, you know, in their in Immigration New Zealand's, like, you know, approved list of businesses, they can just do $5 million. So there's already something in there at the moment in New Zealand. So what we're trying to give is, like, another alternative, another type of investor visa called the Teal Visa, because we're the Teal Party of the Opportunities Party, right? And what we're recognising is that we have some climate opportunities in this space. We recognise that climate change is here, and is coming, and is coming with a vengeance, and that actually we have a responsibility to a lot of our Pacific neighbours who are going to be more affected by this than a lot of other people around the world. You know, we've already got a big Kiribati community in New Zealand, so Kiribati is probably going to be underwater in the next couple of decades. Same with Tuvalu. So we've got a lot of Pacific neighbours that are, you know, their island nations are not going to be there anymore in a couple of decades, right, with rising seawater. So we've got a responsibility to that, and we're probably going to see a lot more climate refugees coming into New Zealand, and we need to be prepared for that. So the Teal Visa is saying that if you're a wealthy individual from overseas and you want to move to New Zealand, fine, put $3 million into this fund, and we can give you a visa. And that fund is to go towards climate opportunities. So funding things like scholarships for people to do climate research, and other sort of climate adaptation, climate mitigation initiatives within New Zealand to make sure that we're ready for the future. And it's an investment into New Zealand, really. You know, if you're a wealthy individual and you want to come to live in New Zealand, you need to contribute, basically, right? That's what the Teal Visa is, really.
That was Dr. Nina Su, the Epsom candidate for the Opportunities Party, speaking about their foreign policy and their housing policy.
That was Dr. Nina Su from the Opportunities Party.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
A record immigration jump of 96,000 people during the first half of this year has sparked both hopes and fears for our economy. To get to the bottom of this, I got two perspectives. One seeing how the jump would affect consumers, and another seeing how it would affect businesses. First, I spoke to economist Dr. Curtin Lees. We spoke about housing availability, the super visa, and the cost of living. Here is that piece now. How are the shortages in the housing and rental markets likely to be affected by the additional 96,000 workers immigrating to New Zealand?
Yeah, sure. So we know from, you know, a whole bunch of work by the Reserve Bank and others that when migrants do come to New Zealand, like everyone else, they will look for housing. And in the short term, that means renting. And then a little bit further down the track, that means looking for a house as well. So more migrants means that house prices will go up. If you think about maybe a 1% increase in migration or net migration, previous work says that house prices might go up by something like 8%.
Are the additional workers good for the economy? How about in relation to inflation?
Yeah, additional workers are good for a whole bunch of reasons. One of those reasons is if we think about kind of the fiscal position or debt position. You know, we took on a whole bunch of debt around the COVID period. And if we have more people, that kind of shares the load. And we've got more people paying more tax to pay off some of that debt we took on across COVID. But also, if you think about migrants, you know, they're there paying tax, but we don't need to pay for the education. So we can get that kind of a break. That's one kind of benefit from migrants. Second sort of set of benefits is the skills and networks migrants bring. So firms bring or want to bring in migrants because they don't have the same skills as workers in New Zealand. And that means that they can increase the productivity of some firms, and also their networks mean they might have some more opportunities to kind of sell goods or open new markets overseas. So that's another way that migrants are good for the economy.
What are the biggest draws for migrants coming to New Zealand?
Yeah, so generally, most migrants are coming for economic reasons. They see opportunity. They see a potential to thrive in an environment that where they live currently, they might not have the same opportunities. They've got some skills that are wanted. And so when they move to an environment that can kind of make the most of those skills, you know, they get a better wage than they would otherwise. And so there's an economic reason for a lot of migration decisions. Sometimes we see a little bit of kind of people moving for family reasons. For example, if you think about Auckland, a lot of people kind of report, one great thing about Auckland is I get to live close to the family. So there might be a brother, sister, mother or father. And that is, we kind of see some patterns around migration that kind of support being close to family. And also the lifestyle. So, you know, there's a lot of good things about New Zealand that are not always true of everywhere that migrants come from.
With the record high cost of living, how are costs expected to be affected by rising immigrant numbers?
Yeah, it's a great question. Eh? I mean, the net migration has been so strong, much stronger than we've seen in the past, well, seen in recent times. But there's two sides of the coin. So on the one hand, the labour market is super tight, so we've never had as many New Zealanders employed. And migration can kind of release some of the bottlenecks. So firms are really good at going, well, if I only had one or two people, here's how I'd be able to improve my supply chain. Then I'd be able to provide goods and services to the market at a lower cost than I can do right now. And so prices would come down a little bit. But of course, the flip side to that is migrants demand goods and services. So they want, you know, some of the things that New Zealanders want. So you'd expect a little bit of demand pressure from people coming into the country. In the past, that has increased inflation, but it's sort of yet to play out on the labour market side of things in terms of whether we'd see that kind of the extent to which those bottlenecks would reduce from being able to bring in more people.
How is Labor's plan to allow parents and grandparents of residents a 10-year stay going to affect the economy?
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. So I think, you know, you're doing those kinds of policies, perhaps not directly for the economic reasons why we might see migration, but you're thinking about in terms of a more sort of stable migrant pool. And, you know, on balance, we know migration's kind of good for the economy, and it, you know, I don't want to over-egg that argument, but, you know, there's a lot of research that points to kind of small benefits from migration to the incumbent population. So migrants benefit, but also the people within New Zealand benefit, just because the economy kind of ticks over a little bit more. So I'd see that as kind of a supporting package of policies to a broader kind of thinking around a points-based migration system.
What sort of policies are important when attracting skilled workers to the country?
Yeah, so I think I know it's really tempting to go, well, if only we could have these people, if only we could have the really high-skilled people. But I think firms and workers are really good at seeing what's happening in their local environment, what are the types of people and skills they need. And central government is just too far away. They're too distant from those little decisions to work out how many people of what kind of type, and that just puts too many lags in the system. So we're far better off to let workers and firms kind of work out what types of people and when, rather than having central government decree that it should be X number of these types of people. I think the more that we can get away from that, the better our migration policy can be.
Are there any particular policies to look out for when it comes to immigration this election?
Yeah, I think we want to get away from a sense of we want to grow the population by 1% or 2% or 3%. You know, I think that's a very kind of dangerous world where we get into a population policy and it sets a particular target for the population or particular growth rate. I just go back to firms and workers being really good at working out what types of people they need and the opportunities they can create. And we simply can't kind of stem the outflow. So we would never prevent New Zealanders kind of leaving. So kind of a population policy where we try and grow the population at 1%, it's very difficult to think about how you would actually implement that kind of a policy. So let's try and steer away from particular specific population policies and let firms and workers get on doing with what they do.
Next, I spoke to barrister and contributor to the Indian Weekender, Dave Ananth. We spoke about the effect of rising immigration on businesses and about policy to attract the best migrants to our country. Here is that piece now. With nearly 100,000 new immigrants coming to the country, how are businesses likely to be affected?
Now, businesses in New Zealand from Queenstown to Auckland need workers. You can see there's a massive shortage of workers, especially in the F&B sector. I've been talking to clients on the ground. There are not many staff willing to work locally. So I think with the immigrants coming in, we need the workers to maintain our businesses, to keep the doors open, to make sure the takeaways, the restaurants, and other businesses in the manufacturing sector continue to do business in New Zealand, Avo.
How do businesses attract the best talent to come to New Zealand?
Now, in terms of talent, Avo, you need to provide something to the immigrants. For example, easier processes of work visas. There's another country which provides work, tourist visa for a tourist to come in for 6 months and look for work. So we need to attract talent, unlike the other countries across the Tasman. We need to make sure that our policies are attractive. At the moment, they are not attractive. I'll just give you an example. The government fees for a standard accreditation is 750 for, I think, one of your questions and in the email was getting a qualified worker accredited. Job check application is 610 and the work visa is 750. But before even the work visa and all that is issued, just government fees alone is just over two grand. And if you include, you know, either the advisor's fee or the solicitor's fee, it can go up to $6,000. So to me, that is quite expensive.
What does New Zealand need to do to make sure we don't fall behind to emerging countries in Asia and the likes of India?
We need to market more, and this is exactly what me and my team and the firm has been doing. We have we engage with embassies, we go out and market to Southeast Asia, countries like Indonesia, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. These are emerging markets which New Zealand has not paid a lot of attention. Just to give you an example today, this evening, we have organized a Waikato-based genetics company to have a conversation with Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. Now, how did we do that? We did that through our connections with the embassy in Wellington. Now, we need to up our ante, because if we don't, we are going to be left far behind.
With already low housing availability, likely to be affected by rising immigration numbers, do we need to increase tax for foreign home buyers? What else can we do to ensure housing availability?
In terms of housing, there has been a lot of talk, but no action, unfortunately, Arvo. Again, we need to partner with either local developers or foreign ones to bring in latest technology in housing. The housing market needs to be looked at with very expensive resource consents by council. A whole revamp needs to be undertaken in this area.
And what do you think about raising taxes?
It's not a good time to raise taxes. There's quite a few businesses are struggling. People are struggling. Prices, inflation is very high. You can go out to the supermarket these days and look at the prices of goods and vegetables. They are very costly. So it is not a good time to increase taxes. In fact, it's a good time to lower your tax bracket.
Finally, this year, a number of stores, especially liquor stores, were reported as underpaying migrant workers. What are the main things to look out for when migrants could be exploited?
I think when I looked at the exploitation of migrants, it really worries me, Alvo. I think what the migrants need to do is do a little bit of their own investigation before they accept a job offer, before they come in line. Go and look at who the advisors are, who the employers are, before they take a flight to come over. And there's no way people should pay 20, 30 grand to get a job in New Zealand. That is absolutely ridiculous. So besides banning recalcitrant employers, I think the employees, potential employees, should also do their homework.
That was Dr. Curtin Lees and Dave Ananth on record immigration numbers in New Zealand.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
What's a seven-letter word for street fighter?
Brawler.
You're right. Hey, what's happening at Ponsonby Social Club this week?
Well, tonight there's
Batiko Beats with Juliana Sion, Amanda Bovo, Timothy Nolia, and guests with support from DJ Bobby Brazuka.
And tomorrow,
DJs Cold Carl, Dishwasher, and Faber Morrow.
Same old Ponsonby Social Club, 152 Ponsonby Road.
I haven't voted before, because I feel like my voice isn't heard.
But I'm not the only one.
If we all had a say
on the issues that matter to us
and our communities,
that would be powerful, right?
Yep.
Let's make our voices heard by voting in this year's general election.
Brought to you by the Electoral Commission.
Sometimes even the greenest of thumbs needs a sidekick against pests. So luckily, Naturally Neem is here to help save the day and your veggies.
Naturally Neem.
Naturally Neem is an effective concentrated pesticide for your garden.
Naturally Neem.
It's safe for all-round food crops and has been carefully created by organic market gardeners in Northland.
Naturally Neem.
Naturally Neem. Kind on us, kind on the environment.
Where are they?
Online. What's the web address?
Head to naturallyneem.co.nz for more info.
Oh, what a day. I love e-scootering. The great outdoors, Richmond Road.
Oh, I've been loving that new Drill Wave Crew synthesis with a C.
Well, we're signed up to My Music Bag. It's so flex. Whatever you're into, they send the same but different stuff in ready-to-bang portions.
Isn't that kind of cheating? I mean, I'm old school. Suggested YouTube videos, Shazam stuff off Netflix. And don't you have all those leftover bass lines?
Obviously, I donate the bass lines here at Vinny's.
The Swap Meet. Old collector guys bring you disco, boogie, funk, and soul to get you cooking. The Swap Meet with Jubbed and Kirk. Sundays 4 till 7 on 95 BFM.
Oi, don't leave your baselines lying around here.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
The AUKUS alliance made between the United Kingdom, Australia and the United States saw the unveiling of plans for 8 new nuclear-powered submarines, costing $368 billion all up. The plans come as tensions rise in the Pacific, especially between China and the United States. Whether or not New Zealand should join the alliance is up for debate. I interviewed Mark Roach, a spokesperson for the Anti-AUKUS Coalition, and asked him why he thinks New Zealand shouldn't join AUKUS.
It's a backdoor way of getting us involved in an anti-Chinese, basically, agreement. So we have no bone. We don't think that we should be preparing for war against China, and we think that would be devastating to our economy and to the world economy, and there would be tens of thousands of deaths if there was. And AUKUS is part of a coalition that the United States is building up in almost preparation for war with China.
What do you think New Zealand joining AUKUS would mean for New Zealand's anti-nuclear identity?
Well, it's a betrayal of it. That's what it is. It's a betrayal of what we as a nation see as part of our makeup. It's basically part of our identity is the fact that we stood up to the nuclear powers in the 80s and 90s and said that we do not want to be part of the nuclear weapons, nuclear warfare system. We won't be involved. We won't have nuclear weapons on our soil or in our ports, and that included nuclear-powered ships. And we stood up as a nation, and all agreed. And basically, it was 89%, I think, support for that law, and decided that we wanted to be a nuclear-free country. And if we join AUKUS, we are then joining a nuclear pact and a betrayal of what I think a vast majority of New Zealanders would rather, would think that it was a betrayal of what we see ourselves as a country in terms of nuclear power and nuclear weapons.
Why do you think it's important to keep New Zealand anti-nuclear? Because I think a lot of people would see some positives to it. Why do you think it's important to keep us anti-nuclear?
Because I think the technology, even though when you think of climate change and all that, and the fact that countries like China are preparing to build, like hundreds of nuclear-powered stations, they're actually going nuclear in terms of power. We don't need it here because we have renewable energy, but we should remain anti-nuclear because nuclear weapons have the capacity to destroy the planet. Within hours. Nobody should have the right or the power to be able to do that. And as a country, I think we have said we do not want to be at the whim of the military powers that have those weapons who are capable of using them and basically destroying life on this planet. So, yeah, why not stay anti-nuclear? Why not keep that principle that we all stood up for in the 80s and 90s?
I also asked Mark about how AUKUS might be adding to concerns about a potential war in the Pacific.
So, if there was a war, considering that 30% of the world's industrial output comes from China, something like 28% of our exports go to China, it would be catastrophic if the United States was to pick a fight with China over Taiwan. It would be absolutely catastrophic for world economy. It would basically throw everything into a depression. But, you know, AUKUS is just part of it. It's just part of that build-up, part of the coalition, part of, you know, ganging up on China. And I think the sort of things that concern me more about China is not their military. I don't, you know, they're of no military threat to New Zealand. We've got no issues with China militarily and all that kind of stuff. We've bought four submarine detections planes, four Poseidon, what they call the eight Poseidon planes, which will do nothing really around New Zealand at all. They're mostly designed for, you know, flying around the China Sea looking for Chinese submarines and all that kind of thing. But we don't really have a beef with China at all, but we're getting dragged into it. And, you know, joining AUKUS is dragging us further into it.
That was Mark Roach, and a spokesperson for the Anti-AUKUS Coalition, speaking about his concerns surrounding New Zealand's potential involvement in AUKUS.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki o mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. Nē rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou I whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Bridge.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.